Welcome to Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome to Extreme Jeans, America's family history show. It is Fisher here, the radio root sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Well, I am excited today because I have the extreme honor of talking to Luke Hunter coming up in about 8-9 minutes. He was on the Arizona at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, one of the fortunate survivors. He's 94 years old, and he's going to tell us all about his experience that day 74 years ago coming up. Very excited about that. And then afterwards, later in the show, I'm going to talk to Dr. Ken Alford about how you can research your World War II ancestors. So this is all going to be great stuff, usable stuff, inspiring stuff on Extreme Jeans. But right now, let's check in with Boston and our good friend from the New England Historic Genealogical Society, the chief genealogist, David Allen Lambert. Hello, David.
Hey, from here in Beantown.
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting interview, and I am really excited to hear what Lou has to say about that experience. Imagine he was just 20 years old at the time.
Amazing. And I know that we still have a handful of those Pearl Harbor veterans. I'm always watching the live feed from December 7th. It's really the twilight era of World War II, but we can't forget the service that they had that day many, many years ago.
That's right.
And some will live a very long time. My first story for Family History News, I love archaeology. And, of course, everyone's heard of King Tut.
And
remember the great song by Steve Martin.
Love that.
But new radar scans have showed that there are probably up to two rooms behind the walls of King Tut's tomb that may be another tomb.
Really?
And it's quite possible that, just like when you're building something, that they could have just added on. And they've always thought that the room that King Tut was in was smaller than most Egyptian pharaohs' tombs. So it's possible in the next coming weeks we could find that there's hidden treasure or archaeological evidence of something from the 14th century BC that we've never laid eyes on yet.
Wow. Won't that be fun?
Well, discoveries are always fun, and one of the ones that really kind of touched my heart was a recent story about a gentleman in Gloucestershire, England, William Gaylor. William was like many other kids back in World War II that had a dad that was a serviceman. Well, in this case, his mom met his dad at a dance over in England. They had a romance. She became with child, and he was shipped out. Well, William was suffering from cancer back about 10 years ago, and he decided he was going to give himself a Christmas gift, find his dad. This is before DNA. Well, for £1.95 in the infancy of the internet, he tracked down his dad and contacted him, visited him. And it was kind of a heart-wrenching thing because I guess his dad had a cancer problem as well. He had a brain tumor, so he wasn't as lucid, it would seem. But he connected and found siblings and came back to England and found out that after his father died that they added him as a beneficiary in the will. So,
wow.
Which wasn't his intention.
Right.
It was nice to read about that. You know, it's funny. I work with some of the leaders in the field here at NEHGS in Boston. One of my dear friends and longtime colleagues is Marie Daly. Well, the other day, it was like Christmas came early, Fish. She came down very excited. Apparently, through Family Search, they've now digitized some of the great records of Ireland, the house, field, tenure, and rent books that are part of what's called Griffith's valuation. This is the era before the famine. So what happens is you find the families in the actual town, and now they're browsable yet. They're not searchable by name. But say if you found David Lambert living in the parish of Drumrah, you find it, and then my name is crossed off the next year and says, gone to America.
Wow.
I mean, we don't have Irish censuses. They don't survive. But this is a census substitute, and these are just a hidden treasure and just one of the great things. And that's why NEHGS loves working with Family Search. And there's so many wonderful databases that are coming out. And this is, like I say, unbeknownst to her, and she's one of the leaders in the field. And I was happy to see her face light up, and I know that every hour she has spent since then has probably been on that looking for her ancestors.
Unbelievable.
My tech tip is one that I'm not sure that we've chatted about before in just regular conversation, but are you aware of archive.org?
Yes, I'm aware of it, but I've never used it.
I want you to give yourself a little bit of a holiday gift. I want you to sign up. You have to just create an account for free, and it has on it currently 8.6 million books, images,
wow,
searchable, 2.2 million movies, 2.7 million songs. It's amazing. And essentially, it has old audio clips of things from long ago. old movies that are, you know, the old black and white silent movies. But what they're doing is they're going library by library and copying things. Unbeknownst to me, they came to my public library, and my high school yearbook is now online, which is frightening.
I'm going to look at that.
Anyways, one more thing to add is at NEHCS and American Ancestors, we have our free guest user database, and we are going German this week with, again, collaboration with Family Search. This includes some German citizen lists from Westfalen and Minden from 1574
to
1902, and the Mecklenburg-Schwerin census of 1890 and 1900. Available just by simply going to AmericanAncestors.org and signing up for a guest user.
There you go. David, good to talk to you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Talk to you soon, my friend.
And coming up next, I'm going to talk to Lou Conter. He was on the Arizona at Pearl Harbor. And of course, we remember what happened on December 7th, 1941, the day President Roosevelt said would live in infamy. And indeed, it has. And there are still heroes among us who lived through that day, and I'm very pleased and honored to have on the phone with me right now one of those heroes, Lou Conter. And Lou is in Grass Valley, California, 94 years young. How are you, Lou?
Fine, thank you.
Take us back to that day, because most of us weren't even alive at the time that happened, yet alone have the ability to remember. Give us a little background about your time in the military and what brought you to Hawaii at that time.
Well, I went aboard the Arizona in Long Beach in the end of 1939 after 3 months of boot camp in San Diego. The fleet was anchored in Long Beach at the time. I went to the 2nd Division in Mexico and back to the 2nd Division, and then I was transferred into the quartermaster gang for navigation training. And then on April 1st of 1940, the fleet left Long Beach and went to Honolulu, or Pearl Harbor. And then after the exercise were done, they based the fleet permanently in Pearl Harbor instead of Long Beach. And so then we operated from April 1st on. Half the fleet would go out for 10 days and then come back in. And then up to the end of 1940, we went to Bremen for overhaul for two and a half months and came back to Honolulu in 1st of January of 1941.
So you enlisted then during the time of the Depression, yes?
Yeah, out of high school.
A lot of people did that at that time, didn't they, because of the economic situation?
Well, you know, we went in the Navy for 4 years. We got $17 a month for the first 3 months, and then $21 a month to our made seaman second class, and $36. But we had board and room, too, and had hammocks that we slept in. We had a hook in the beams in the ship, and we slept in hammocks until after we went to overhaul, and they put bunks in four high. And of course, a lot of the guys would rather stay in their hammocks than they got used to it. So you got three guys sleeping underneath you or something. But,
wow. Did you anticipate at the time that you enlisted that you might wind up going to war during those 4 years, or was it just, hey, here's a way to make a living?
Well, no, I think that there was half and half at the time in 38, 39, but then after we went to Pearl Harbor in April of 40, we all knew that we were going to go to war, but we just didn't know when.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a matter of time because, you know, we operated up and down the 180th Meridian, and we couldn't cross it because we had 14-inch guns aboard the battleships. And when the Japanese came across in the Northern Pacific on December the 4th with their battleships and carriers, there was really an act of war on the 4th of December instead of waiting until the 7th because they crossed the 180th without permission and under silence.
Hmm.
That was the date, December 4th, that President Roosevelt got the message from the embassy in Jakarta that the Japanese fleet had gone to sea, and they had sent the message, east wind rain, which meant that Pearl Harbor would be attacked within 72 hours.
Now, what were you doing that day? December 7th, 1941, you're a young kid. You're what, 20 years old at that point?
20 years old. I was just took over quartermaster of the watch. When we were in port, we're quartermaster of the watches on the quarterdeck down by where the gangplanks are, going over to the vessel and over the Liberty boats. And when we're at sea, it's up on the bridge with the captain. Because the quartermasters do the navigation and star sights and keep the logs and things like that. So our station was between turret 3 and the mainmast.
And you were on the Arizona the morning of the attack?
Yes, when they first came over on the quarterdeck with Sonata General Quarters, and the band was getting ready to play for Colors at 5 to 8, and as soon as Sonata General Quarters, they went to their battle stations, and they were all killed, the same as all of my quartermaster buddies were killed. And 5 minutes later, I would have been on the bridge with the captain, but he said to secure the quarterdeck first. So we had to throw the lines off from the Arizona to the Vestal, get the Vestal away from us so we could get underway and get to sea, because we had just come in on Friday, and we had refueled, and we had a full load of fuel and ammunition and everything else, and we had to get the Vestal away from us to get away from the docks.
Right. And so you were on the ship at that point. Of course, it was a panicked situation.
Everybody knew it was the Japanese. And like Commander Fuqua said after the raid, in his official statements, that everyone on the ship performed extraordinarily well, and there was no one individual that outlasted the other one. Because we were well trained. We'd been to sea, you know, since April 1st, 1940, practically 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And all we did at sea was train for war with Japan.
Right.
In the Pacific. And so we were well trained, and everybody acted when they went to their stations immediately. It took us 50 years to get off of the news reports and everything that the band had played in the Battle of Bands the night before, which they did not. There were a few people of the band over there watching them, but they did not play. They were going to play the following week or week after that. And the newspaper said that they were allowed to sleep in that morning. They got killed in their bunks, and none of them were killed in their bunks. They were all at their battle stations. Everybody was at their battle station by 7:58. We sounded general quarters at 7:55, and it doesn't take them 2 to 3 minutes to get to their battle stations and secure all the watertight doors and everything else.
And so for you that day, this attack came along. You're below deck, so you escaped harm while all your buddies were lost.
We were on top of the deck, between turret 3 and 4 on the quarter deck, and that's why everybody below deck practically got killed, except a few, and we got out of turret 4. Everybody else that survived was above decks and in turret 3 or 4, and then there were 5 men on the foremost above the bridge, the fire controlman. After the blast, the Vestal threw a line across to them, and they came down the line, and 3 of them got over to the Vestal, burned about 75% of their body, and the other 2 dropped into the water.
How did you escape, Lou?
Well, you never know how you escape. You're just lucky that you didn't get killed that day, too. But we were on the quarterdeck, and when Commander Fruco got knocked out with a bomb over by turret 4, and he came through and took charge, and he was our senior officer aboard, our first lieutenant. Had people coming out of the fire, we laid him down on the deck to save him, to get him into the motor launches to the hospital. And then water started coming up on the deck, and he said, abandoned ship. It was about 25 to 9 or something when he said that. And the ones that survived got over the side and into Fort Island, or else they got into the motor launches. And then we got in the motor launch and picked up bodies and parts of bodies out of the water because the whole fleet was burning. And we fought the fire on the Arizona until Tuesday. And they got out, and we took a rest for 3 or 4 days, and then we started diving on the ship to try to bring up bodies. And after 5 or 6 days, we were in shallow water helmets, and Pete Uzar was our main diver, the water tender first, and he dove in a regular suit and stayed down 4, 5, 6 hours, and we'd stay down maybe 30, 40 minutes is all in the water, shallow water helmet, somebody pumping air in the deck.
Right.
But after 5 or 6 days, Pete decided it was too dangerous. We were getting the air hoses caught on the doors and everything else. And so they called it off, and we abandoned ship, and that was it. The survivors went to other ships from Base Force, went to other ships, to destroyers and everything that was able to go to sea. I went to Commander Base Force, and Captain Geiselman, who was our executive officer, was made Provost Marshal in Honolulu, because martial law was declared immediately, without an environmental impact report or any other hearings, and the military took over, and Captain Geisman was appointed Provost Marshal, and he called Pete and I in to patrol the streets and help. And anybody in Honolulu, after sunset, was restricted from going out, or before sunrise, or they get shot.
Wow.
And so I lasted there until first part of January. We had our orders, Johnson from 5th Division, I had our orders to flight school November 1st, and Captain Van Valkenburg called us down and said, We're going back to Long Beach to pick up our 1.1 December the 19th, so you go back with us and go to Pensacola from there. But we lost our orders on the Arizona December 7th, so it was about the first week in January when I was over at Hitchcock's house for dinner. Admiral Calhoun came in and said, I thought you went to flight school, and I told him we lost our orders. And it wasn't 3 or 4 days, they pulled Johnny off a destroyer and myself, and we were on the Lurline back to San Francisco and went to Pensacola to flight school. As he was a gunner's mate and I was a quartermaster second class.
Now let's talk about how this has affected your life. You were 20 years old at the time. I mean, you were just a kid. Obviously, it was a horrific thing, and I'm sure that it was more painful as you looked back on it. Talk about that a little bit, how that impacted you and your ability to function going forward through the war and since.
Well, we handled it the way we were trained. We had high, hard training on site, and we handled it that way, and that's the way we had to do it. We knew we had to win the war and go, so we did what we had to do. And like Lauren Bruner was on the Arizona, and he lives in La Mirada now. He's 95, and he was one of the ones who came off the foremast and was burned over 75% of his body. They put him to the hospital until July of 42, and he was pretty well then, and they said, you're well to go back to duty, and they put him on a destroyer, and he didn't see the United States until January 1946. Don Stratton, who was on the Arizona, got burned, and he spent 2 years in the hospital, and he came out with a medical, but he's still living in Colorado Springs, too. And John Anderson is our senior petty officer aboard. He's a boatswain mate, and he's 99 now, and his twin brother was killed in the Arizona. So they have different thoughts, you know.
Sure.
And I've learned in survival the will to live, and you've got to be positive thinking all the time, and the will to live.
He's Lou Conter. He's a veteran of World War II, survived the Arizona. And sir, we thank you for your service. Thank you for your time and sharing your story with everybody. And we wish you well through your current trial with your wife's illness.
Thank you very much.
Wow. And coming up, Dr. Ken Alford is going to join me, and we're going to teach you how to track the records of your World War II ancestors on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, and I got to tell you, I'm still just taking all of it in that we just heard from Lou Conter about surviving the Japanese attack on the Arizona at Pearl Harbor back on December 7th, 1941. And with that, I think it makes a lot of sense to bring on Dr. Ken Alford. He is a professor at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, to talk about researching your World War II ancestors. So many of them, I think now, Ken, are gone more than are still with us. Where do we start if we want to research our World War II ancestor?
The great news is World War II was documented from beginning to end. And so listeners that have ancestors and relatives that fought in World War II are bound to find something. Unlike other wars, this is probably the best documented war we've got, and everything is available is the good news. When you start, what you want to do is there's four key pieces of information that you want to find on your veteran, and you may not find them all in the same place, you may not find them all at the same time, but these are the four things you want first. You want to know which branch of service they were in. Second is you want to find out generally their periods of service, and you want to find out where they served. You know, were they in the Pacific? Did they stay stateside? Did they go into Europe? Were they in North Africa? And then fourth, you want to know, how did they serve? What was their rank? Were they enlisted, non-commissioned officer, some kind of sergeant? Or did they serve as a warrant officer or even as a commissioned officer? Because it turns out the higher the rank, the more records you're going to find, is just kind of the relationship.
That makes sense, sure.
Then once you do that, a lot of people think that military records are just kind of, all homogenous. But there are many different kinds of records. And interestingly, especially for World War II, there are military records for people that didn't serve in the military.
Huh.
And I know that sounds a little bit weird, but actually what happened is it was a period of the draft in which the draft was extended very broadly. So most male ancestors will have some kind of draft registration record. And that's the first category of these records. They're called pre-service records.
Okay.
They're records created by the government, and the people may or may not serve. And so draft registration records, for example, my grandfather never served in World War II. He was too old, and they didn't take the draft that high, but he was in the age group where they had to register. So we've got his registration records, and they contain a wealth of information. I mean, including eye color, hair color, and height.
Right.
And so they're just wonderful records. The other kind of pre-service records are the documents that actually turn someone from a civilian into a soldier or a sailor or a Marine. They're enlistment documents for non-commissioned officers and enlisted, and they are commissioning documents for the officers, because there are many different commissioning sources, such as ROTC, Officer Candidate School, direct commissions, and so on. So those are all kind of pre-service records. The second category of records is what are called service records. And as the name implies, these are records that are generated while the people are on active duty. And there can be just a host of records, depending on how long they served, where they served, if they received awards, the orders that transferred them. And eventually, if there's discharge papers or if they were captured, all of those kinds of records are kept by the government because they're all official.
That's exciting, though, to know that that's out there.
The third category of records is, as you would expect, if there's a pre-service, there's going to be post-service. Post-service records contain things like a killed in action records or a separation or discharge, because no matter when you serve or how long you serve, at some point you will leave the service, either through death or through some kind of separation or discharge. The government documents that in forms. Everyone that also served gets something called a Form DD-214, and that DD-214 is a record of your military service. It's family history gold, because what it has in just two pages is a summary of the entire service of that service member. If you only get one document from a family member who served in World War II, you want to search for that DD-214.
Oh, that's good to know.
Another great piece of documentation, and it's not going to be nearly as concise, are pension papers.
Yes.
Because when you receive a check from the government, they're going to require a huge amount of documentation. And you can also find things in pension papers like vital record information, complete spelling of names, military units, description of service, including campaigns and battles and awards, their physical description, a description of their health, where they lived, who their heirs are. I mean, it's just wonderful.
And that really applies to most wars of the United States.
Yes.
The pension records are fabulous.
It does indeed. So where do you look for this information? You know what you want, and you're just not sure where Grandpa served. I would recommend that listeners simply start with the obvious choices of Ancestry.com and Fold3.com. They have digitized a lot of government records, and that's the one shop where they will find more in the quickest amount of time than any of these other websites I'm going to give you. And so start there. Next, I would actually do a search for your local newspapers. If you know where Grandpa or Great-Grandpa lived and went into the service from, there was probably a newspaper article generated at the time.
And so many of them are digitized now on places like MyHeritage, Newspapers.com, GenealogyBank.com, also Chronicling America through the Library of Congress.
Absolutely. And many states have taken the bull by the horns and have digitized state newspapers. For example, for listeners that live in the state of Utah, there's a website called Utah Digital Newspapers that has many, many newspaper archives, and they're just wonderful, and they're all free. The federal government, as you would expect, since they collect all this stuff, has started making it available. It's not all digital yet, but much of it is. Let me just give your listeners some of these websites and places that I would send them to for the next round. After you've found everything you can find at Ancestry and Fold 3, then go to the federal sources. I would go first to the National Archives.
Right.
If you go to their website, it's just archives.gov. And they have a huge wealth of information. Much of it is digitized. You can obtain these microfiche and microfilm through genealogical centers across the nation. And if you're in Washington, D.C., I highly recommend a visit to the National Archives. It's free, but you can actually hold your grandfather's records in many cases in your hand.
Wow.
And then you can make a copy of them there. And that's just something fun.
And that's a thrill in itself, isn't it?
It is a huge thrill. The next thing I would recommend is to check the National Personnel Records Center, the NPRC, at St. Louis. And you can actually find it through a link off of the National Archives website. Now, the good news is if your ancestors' records are there, you will receive a folder And there are small charges that apply, but I have seen some of these that are 2 and 3 inches thick of just genealogical gold. That's the good news. The bad news is, in 1973, a fire destroyed 80% of their records.
Yeah.
And most of the World War II records, I just hate to say this, were burned. But you always try. The next place I would check is the Veterans Administration. That's va.gov. And then I would send them also to the Library of Congress, and that's just loc.gov. And the Library of Congress will not have records, but they will have photos and unit histories.
Oh.
And you may find grandpa or great-grandpa in those secondary sources. I would also encourage your listeners to go to state archives and local military museums. And lastly, I would just add before we close this off that since this is World War II, this is now really the first war in American history where we have sizable numbers of women who serve in either the WAVES or the WACS or in auxiliary corps, and there are millions of female records as well.
I wish we had more time, Ken. This is fabulous. So helpful for a lot of people. If you miss this, of course, listen again on the podcast in the coming week, and you can find out all kinds of things to write down about how to track down your World War II ancestor. Thanks for coming on, Dr. Alford.
Thank you very much.
And coming up next, it is Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, our preservation authority, on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Time to talk preservation with our preservation authority, Tom Perry. And Tom, we were talking just very recently about using the cloud as the place not only to store your digitized films and videos, but also to edit them from right there. So my question to you is, I have the old hard drives of the old home movies from back in the 1950s and 60s, but they're in an AVI form because I have a PC. Do I need to transfer those into MP4 format in order to edit them or leave them just as they are?
One thing that's really important to understand is the difference between your AVIs, which you have because you're a PC, the MOVs, which most Mac people use, and then your MP4s, which are cross-platform that anybody can edit from.
Right.
So the answer to your question is yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, you're fine. You don't need to do anything with the MP4s. No, don't leave them as AVIs. Make MP4s also, because now you can put them up in the cloud. You have your wheel, and it has a hub in the middle, and just take all your items, your MP4s, put them up there. And the neat thing about the MP4s that I like is they're small, but they're good quality. So any good program that will let you take your AVIs, your MOVs, your XYZs, and turn them into MP4s. And so once they're in MP4s, anybody in your family can edit.
Right.
If they're Mac, PC, they're not saying, oh, hey, it's the problem editing. These files are so big. I hate your AVIs. Where MP4s are the same, whether you're a PC or a Mac.
But if you're the only one using it, and you're using a PC, then it wouldn't make any sense at all to change it to an MP4.
Oh, no. If you're on an island and you're an only child and nobody else is interested in any stuff you have, then yeah, stay with your AVIs or your MOVs and just do your own thing. However, the biggest thing is getting this stuff spread out. Sometimes people just get so confused with all the different things going on, they don't know where to start. Now that everything's getting down to something as simple as an MP4, it's easier for people to access. You say, hey, I have these MP4s, and there's some pictures of, you know, your daughter's birthday that happened to be on mom and dad's film. And so they can go and click immediately and play the MP4 on their tablet, on their smartphone, anywhere.
It's universal.
It is. It's quick. And then they're going to get excited and say, hey, this is really cool. I wonder if I can put these things together. And then they see how easy the MP4s are to edit. And they say, hey, this is kind of fun. And once they get bit by the bug, they'll really get into it. And the younger and younger these kids are, we have kids that are in kindergarten that are accessing now MP4s and AVIs and MOVs and doing editing. And the work they're doing without any training is really mind-boggling. And the neat thing is, we mentioned, oh, I guess it's probably been a couple months ago when Apple released its new, I guess it's called the iPad Pro, the big one. There's some special software for that that Adobe has developed for drawing and editing and taking all these MP4s or whatever you have and doing cool things with them. And these younger kids, and they're going to be able to take this stuff and start editing it. And when you're watching over their shoulder, seeing what these kids can do, it's amazing. It's like they've got these manuals already programmed right into their brain from birth. They already know what things look good, how concepts work. We've talked about the rule of thirds when you're shooting so your videos look more pleasing. These kids are shooting stuff that looks so good, it's like they've already had the training. And there's a lot of good books you can find online that you can actually get better with this. The neat thing about these MP4s in the clouds, it's so simple. Just like in the old days, now that you have your old films, your Super 8s and your 8s transferred to DVD, you pop them in and watch them. You don't have to pull out your projector. You don't have to pull out your screen. You don't have to do all this stuff. It's the exact same thing with the MP4s now. You don't have to get this big computer program. You don't have to get all this kind of software. You don't have to get this. You need to get trained on this. And the learning curve is killer. Now with Lightjar, you can take just a simple MP4 and edit right out of the box. You don't have to have any editing experience or anything. And as you mentioned a few weeks ago, you can share with your family and friends as a collaborative effort. And after the break, we can give you some more ideas.
All right. Fisher here with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He's our preservation authority. And we're talking about the compatibility of all the platforms now. You know, when you think about it, Tom, we talk about PCs, we talk about Macs, but you can go back a lot further and talk about the Super 8s, VHS, Mini 8s. I mean, all those things now are coming together where they can all be scanned into one format that everybody can use and everybody can easily edit. This is a very exciting time.
It just makes it so easy. They can download them, watch them instantly. They can watch them on the cloud, or if they want to have them in their library, they can download them to their hard drive.
Now, you were talking a few weeks ago about Google with this new tool for photographs where you would have a picture of a waterfall and it actually moves like the water's coming down.
Exactly.
I mean, when you add that kind of thing in with video and you can assemble something where you use still pictures and narration and film, everybody can become a film editor of their own stuff. And it makes it more desirable for everybody of all ages to be a part of.
Oh, it's great. Like you just mentioned the new iPhone, where you take a still picture. I've done this before. I took a still picture that, oh, darn it, I wish it would have gotten video. Or, oh, I did this video, I wish I would have taken a still. With this new technology that Apple has out now, you take a still, and you can still turn it into a video. I don't know how the magic happens, but it's pretty cool. And that's another neat thing about the MP4s, again. When you're editing, you can take the videos, you can take the slides you've had scanned, you can take the old photographs that have been torn that you've restored in Photoshop, and put them all together and make something that's really, really fun, that's really, really cool. And the neat thing about the MP4s, again, is they're so small, you can scan through them easily. Anybody can download them. It doesn't matter what kind of a device you have. You can have access to your MP4s. It's incredible.
So to start with, then, somebody needs to take all their films, their old films or their old home movies or their videos, and get them scanned into this format. At that point now, and even scan photographs, right?
Oh, absolutely.
That's how you get all the material saved, and now you have it in this collaborative cloud. And people can actually go in and access it and either comment on it or identify people in it or snatch certain pieces of it out for their own use because it has to do specifically with their family or their side of the family. But getting started is the key thing here.
And you need to move on it because the biggest problem you're going to run into with your old slides, your film, anything, if you hold it up to a light, you can see through it. Those things are fading. They're fading. Even
That's
if
right.
they've been in a dark, cool place the whole time, just because of how they were developed, whether mom, pa did it, whether Kodak did it, whoever did it, is going to affect how fast they start going away. Start now so we can start enjoying it so the family can have it. We'll have access to it. And it's easy and quick to do.
You know, the bottom line is, if you're afraid of this technology and what it takes to learn how to edit and put these things together, you should be far more afraid of letting your videos and old home movies fading out and being lost forever.
Oh, that is so true. If you're sitting on it, it's not doing anybody any good, and it's going to go away. You need to get this stuff transferred now. If you need help of places to find locally, give us a call, and we'll try to help you find a local place that can help you out.
All right, Tom. Great stuff. Good to see you again. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be back.
And that wraps up our show for this week on Extreme Genes. And special thanks to Lou Conter for coming on the show and talking about his experience of being on the Arizona as it was being attacked by the Japanese on December 7th, 1941. Thanks also to Dr. Ken Alford from Brigham Young University for talking about how to track the military records of your World War II ancestors. Talk to you again next week. Take care. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.